Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Arun. Arun qualified as an engineer and worked in the engineering field for 6 years, living in a city. That experience drove him out of cities, mainstream life, and thought. He took up teaching in a Krishnamurti school, and alongside that, he took up sea turtle conservation. He's been a conservationist and teacher for the past 22 years. For the past 10 years, he's lived with his family on an organic farm, running an alternative school and an afforestation project along with a group of passionate individuals. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Lily, for having me.
So can you tell us about Olive Ridley sea turtles? That's the one you work mainly with, right?
Yeah, that's the one that come and nests on our coast in Chennai, along the eastern coast of India.
So can you tell people who may not know a lot about sea turtles in general, and specifically Olive Ridley sea turtles, can you talk about them some?
Oh, they're fascinating creatures. Sea turtles are really captivating, fascinating creatures. For one, they have been around for a very long time. The ancestral sea turtle ancestors began 220 million years ago. That's right at the start with the dinosaurs, you know. And the modern sea turtles as we know them, and they have been around for 110 million years, almost unchanged. So these creatures are really ancient. And when you see them, when you get to see them coming to nest or something like that, you realize you are in the presence of a animal which has been around for a very long time, a prehistoric animal. And when you watch her birthing process, laying eggs on the beach, somehow there is a time warp. You kind of feel time has come to a standstill. You know, there's something, everybody over the last 22 years who have had the good fortune of seeing a turtle nest have been mesmerized, you know, have been touched by the process, have gone away saying, oh my God, that was something very special, you know. I very rarely met any human being who was not touched by watching an ancient process. Also, I guess it's a life-giving process. So that's one, that the fact that they are been around for a very long time, they've survived climate changes, they have survived all kinds of changes that the world has gone through, that they are survivors, that they are ancient is one fascinating feature. Well, second one I would say is, there's an ancient term used to describe them. They're called ancient mariners. They are the original marines, you know. They travel the ocean. They are there all over the world. Actually, there are 7 species of sea turtles in the world. And they travel the world's oceans, largely tropical oceans, except the largest one of them. I'll come to that later. But the entire tropical zone, all the oceans of the world are, traveled by sea turtles, and every beach in every tropical region is used for turtles to nest there. In fact, a lot of people who come to Chennai, the city that I work in, they say, why do turtles come to Chennai? What's special about Chennai? And I tell them, sorry, nothing special about Chennai. Chennai is just one of the beaches in the world where turtles nest. What's special is that we are doing some conservation work here. In fact, Olive Ridleys themselves nest in 100 countries, you know. So they are all over the world. They are international citizens, you know, making them quite fascinating. The third thing I would say is that they have these nesting beaches, and then they have their foraging, feeding beaches. And these could be very far apart. For instance, closer home to you, the loggerhead turtle, the turtle with the largest head, travels between Mexico and Japan, you know. Japan is the nesting ground and Mexico is the feeding ground. And then we have it the other way. Florida is the nesting ground. And I don't know where these come from, Japan or other parts of the world, but they're traveling 12,000 kilometers one way, either to feed or to nest, you know. And turtles are doing this all over the place like that, like traveling long, long distances every year. So the turtles that come to Chennai, to the eastern coast of India to nest, they travel a little less. They travel definitely up to Sri Lanka or up to Indonesia. And every year there is this migratory pattern where they in September or October, they come to the Indian waters. There is a mating time. Then there's a gestation period, and then they start nesting. And the male turtles leave after the, after the mating time. But the female turtles stay on, and each species of turtles has a different pattern of nesting. Some nest once or twice a year, twice a year at the very least. And the largest turtle, leatherback, it nests as many as 12 times in a season. And so after this nesting season is over, they travel back to wherever they came from. So about, except for the nesting and mating time, they are constantly traveling, you know, all over. So in Andaman, Nicobar Islands, further south from India, there are four species of turtles which come and nest there. And one of them is the leatherback. And those turtles, of late, my associates have been radio tracking them and seeing where they come from. It's quite fascinating. 3 years back, there were seven turtles which were radio tracked. And three of them went towards Australia and four of them went towards Africa, you know, just after the nesting. Fascinating. So that the fact that they travel these long distances. Then the fourth thing would be the turtles come back to the same place they were born in. And this is really mind-blowing because unlike other organisms that we know of, that we are familiar with, where there is a whole parenting process, here turtles are not that kind of parents, you know. They lay the eggs and they go away, and then there is no connection with the eggs. Though in a lot of mythology, they believe the mother comes back and stuff like that. They never come back. In fact, I normally say turtles make perfect babies because the babies are completely capable of taking care of themselves. Once they emerge from the nest, they just are programmed to move towards the sea, and they come out with a swimming frenzy and swim out. And so they are out into the sea within a couple of hours, a few hours of birthing. And then they are washed by the currents, they are taken by the surf, whatever. And then, depending on the species, 12 years later, 15 years later, 30 years later, some species, when they are sexually mature and ready to start nesting, they come back to the place they were born. Now, this is mind-blowing. How do they know that? Well, at least in migratory birds and stuff, you have the parents and adult birds following migratory patterns moving around. Here, these have to find their path. Of course, once they hit the right path, they will be following ocean currents, and there are other turtles as well, probably swimming in the same direction. But imagine a baby, you know, for the first time ever, could be any part of the world, has to find its, you know, birthing ground where it has to go and start its own process again. Quite fascinating. So there are many, many things. I could just go on. Or for example, the number of eggs that they lay. It's fascinating. Like Olive Ridley's lay, in a single sitting, they lay anything between 120 and 180 eggs the first time around. And between 250 and 400 eggs in a season. And the leatherback, 60 to 100 eggs every sitting and 12 times. So 1,200 eggs in one process, you know, in one season. I could go on. I'll just tell you one more. The turtles are known to have a sperm bank. So in their multiple matings, they can store their sperm and draw the sperm that they want and fertilize the number of eggs that they want. And, you know, they seem very advanced beings, you know. And the most, for me, the most endearing is that they are very peaceful creatures. I mean, with all measures of association, they are very quiet, peaceful creatures, you know, very, very different from humans, I must say.
So there are so many directions I'd love to go with this. There's so many great things you said. But before we even do that, one of the things that about halfway through, it suddenly occurred to me something you said at the beginning. If they were around before the dinosaurs, that means that they have lasted through
Mass extinction.
Multiple mass extinctions.
Yeah, definitely the last the 66 million year old mass extinction, they survived that for sure. And they have survived ice ages, and they have survived extreme changes to the planet. And their design is unchanged. Somewhere nature seemed to have created a type which would survive everything, you know, all changes.
And then in a minute, I want to go back to just talk a little bit about more like who do they eat, who eats them. But before then, you know, I live in a place with a creature who also comes home, which is salmon. And, you know, salmon return to the stream where they began.
Right.
Except about, I've read about 2 to 3%, go to the wrong stream. Wrong is in quotes here.
Right.
Because that's how they can inhabit new streams. That's how they can re-inhabit places where they've been wiped out. And so do some of the turtles go to, do you think some of the turtles might go to the wrong beach to be able to help them re-inhabit if something happens?
I definitely think so. Otherwise, see, they say for the olive ridleys, like humans, Africa to humans, the olive ridleys were born in Odisha, in India. That's the largest nesting beach in the world, you know. Though they these turtles are known to mass nest. We'll come to that in a while. But the largest nesting beach for olive ridleys is in the eastern coast of India in the state of Odisha. And they say they started life there. Obviously, if they're nesting in 100 countries now, they're not so fixated on coming back to the birthing place alone. There is some sort of exploration also. And also we have seen, when we say birthing beach, that it varies by 10 or 15 kilometers. You know, could be, 10 kilometers accuracy, let's say. But having said that, I must also say that once a beach is destroyed, a birthing beach is destroyed, they look for other places. They are willing to move. So over millions of years, there must have been a number of reasons why, how they spread to a wide range of places, you know. But some amount of, yeah, wrong, like you say, within quotes, wrong beaches must be one of the reasons how they managed to spread out so much.
So another thing I was wondering, just sort of technically, is I interviewed somebody a couple years ago about dragonflies. And he said that there are some species of dragonflies who begin their lives in India, and then they end up in, and then they lay eggs in Africa. And then those babies lay eggs and are starred in Africa, and they come back, and they fly. They go on the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So do these turtles tend to? I presume when they're going 12,000 miles, they've figured out to sort of hitch a ride on a current a lot of times.
Yes, they do.
And
but they see, dragonflies and butterflies complete their, you know, they complete a route, one complete circle of a travel over multiple generations, right? But turtles don't do that. I mean, they come back in their own lifetime. So see, their lifespan is similar to humans, right? So they mature around 12 to 15 years and live to about 100 years. I'm talking about sea turtles now, and have a sexually active period of about 30, 40 years, and they nest about maybe twice in 3 years. So about 20 nesting seasons or 25 nesting seasons in their lifetime. But all of these are largely in the same set of beaches, you know. So the Malaysian turtles nest in Malaysia, and the Australian turtles nest in Australia. I mean, I'm saying if that's their nesting ground, by and large, that continues to remain their nesting ground. Though even recently we have seen, like, the tsunami affected the Andaman Nicobar Islands. It shifted the beaches, and there has been a shift in nesting patterns. In India, there are a lot of beaches which are getting completely eroded due to industrial development or building of new ports or whatever. One does see that they do move around, but by and large they come back to their nesting beach, you know.
So if they're laying that many eggs and they're living that long, the mortality of the babies must be pretty huge.
Very, very, very huge. So even without human intervention, it is calculated that about 1 in 1,000 reaches adulthood. So, in fact, it's interesting. Part of the turtle lore is that they bring nutrients out of the sea, you know. So, largely, the nutrient flow is towards the sea, right? These are actually carrying them out. And there are a number of shore living animals who time their reproductive season with turtle nesting. So many parts of the world, you have various animals, like various birds. It depends on where you are. Like, you know, we can have, we have shore birds, we have even vultures, we have monitor lizards, we have hyenas, foxes, jackals, raccoons, you know, a whole bunch of animals who are timing their reproduction to the turtle nesting season. So it's a very huge resource base, turtle eggs. And of course, humans have consumed turtle eggs over millennia. What has changed is the pattern of collection of eggs. So I was reading that in Malaysia, almost complete collection of eggs without leaving anything to nature has what has destroyed the Malaysian nesting habitats. You know, a drop in about 99% says that. Turtle eggs are a part of it. If it's eggs, and then the young ones are eaten by fish, there are a lot of fish just waiting for these hatchlings to come into the sea, you know. And yeah, so like you're right. So 1 in 1,000 without human intervention is the survival rate.
And if they make it, well, how big is Olive Ridley? And if they make it to what size, are they probably going to be okay?
So Olive Ridley's are the smallest of the sea turtles. They grow to about 70 centimeters, about 2.5 feet. Okay. Adult turtles are quite, they don't have too many predators. They're quite safe once you reach adult stage. But before I want to talk about the largest turtle because it's quite fascinating. So Olive Ridley is the smallest. Then we have its close cousin called the Kemp's Ridley, which lives close to Mexico, North America. And we have slightly progressively bigger sizes, loggerhead, green turtle, which is 4 feet. And then we have the largest of them all, which is the leatherback. Now, the leatherback on an average is about 5 to 6 feet, but can easily grow larger. I think the largest found specimen was about 12 feet long, and weighed 2,000 pounds. That's a huge animal, you know. And once they reach that kind of size, I mean, there are no real predators. Apparently, sharks go for them, but I've not met a leatherback in person, but I've read that they can swim circles around sharks. They are very dexterous swimmers. In our folk understanding, Indian understanding, they confuse tortoises with turtles, right? And some tortoises are the slow-moving creatures, you know, the tortoise and the hare, you know, that kind of imagery is there in the mind. But turtles are anything but slow. They travel long distances. They are fast swimmers, and they are pretty. They can take care of themselves. Also, saltwater crocodiles, wherever they are in the world. In Andaman Islands, we have saltwater crocodiles. They are a threat, but not in water. They are vulnerable when they come on land because they are slow moving. So there are instances where a leatherback came to nest, and she was attacked by a saltwater crocodile. Our researchers found, they thought she was nesting, and they went near, they saw there was no head, the crocodile had taken the head alone. And there are instances like that, but in water, once they grow to adult size, they are safe. But in the process of growing, definitely they are vulnerable. I would say halfway through their life growth, they might become coming to the safe zone. If they are slow, no? It takes, I mean, I've seen turtles about a plate size, dinner plate size, that they're probably about 2 years old at that stage. Still vulnerable. They need to grow bigger to become safe.
And what do sea turtles eat?
Sorry, you broke up there.
What do sea turtles eat?
Right. So three of them are specialized feeders. The largest of them all, surprise, surprise, eats only jellyfish. I mean, jellyfish is mostly water. So they are grown that size eating water. But they are, they are specialized jellyfish eaters, for which they can dive 1,000 meters into the sea. They can dive pretty deep, hold their breath for 70 minutes, you know. and that's their specialized diet, which is the leather bags. Then green turtles are largely herbivorous. They eat seagrass. Quite fascinating, because their role in maintaining seagrass beds is very vital. And there are not too many animals which do that. Like there are the dugongs and the sea cows who do that. And the green turtles do that. So they maintain seagrass beds. And seagrass beds, you know, are vital for spawning of marine fish, you know. And today, of course, seagrass beds are disappearing, and green sea turtles are disappearing, and dugongs are mostly gone. But that's their specialized feeding, seagrass beds. And then the hawksbill. Hawksbill is quite a fascinating creature. It's perhaps the most beautiful sea turtle, and therefore has been hounded. But a beautiful sea turtle which lives, that's the only sea turtle which has a very clear territory. It lives on a coral reef. It has a home range. It has a piece of coral which it calls its home, like, and it'll defend it from other, you know, hawksbill turtles. And they swim between this particular range of corals to the nesting beach and back. They are specialized feeders too. They eat only sponges. It's like eating glass, you know. But they prevent sponges from smothering coral reefs. So these three are specialized feeders. The other four, olive ridleys and loggerheads and Kemp's ridley and the Australian flatback, they eat a variety of things. They would eat echinoderms, mollusks, fish, crabs, whatever, all kinds of things. They eat much varied diet. But all of them are top predators and are critical in maintaining the balance in the times the was balance.
So you said earlier that, I don't remember which species, but you were saying that they maintain seagrass. You said that about sea cows too.
Green sea turtles. Yes.
Yeah. And I really love that. You didn't say that they eat you did say they eat seagrass, but then you said maintain. Can you talk about how?
No, they are like grazers. Like, they see the seagrass beds are, you know, they need to be, they shouldn't overgrow too much. You know, they're cropped. You may say they are cropped to a certain extent to keep them accessible to fish to come and, you know, spawn. And if they were to overgrow, become too dense, then it will be difficult for the fish. I'm out of my area of expertise here. But green turtles, you know, have their patches where they are constantly grazing. And they say the health of the habitat, of a seagrass habitat, is very much connected to the presence of turtles.
You know, earlier you said how there are so many species who time their reproduction to the sea turtles, and how they're a huge influx of nutrients. And now you mentioned this, and of course, again, living here in a salmon-based forest, I'm very aware of these nutrient runs up from the ocean. It just makes me, when you were talking, I was just feeling awe at the sort of miraculousness of how nature works.
Amazing. Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know if you want to talk anything else about, you know, if you have other amazing things about sea turtles that you want to
talk about. Yeah, yeah. No, leatherbacks, they are quite fascinating. So they lay the 60 to 100 eggs, right? So one of the things that they do is that they lay up to 50% of the eggs are dummy eggs, unfertilized eggs. So what they do is their fertilized eggs are laid at the bottom of the nest, and then the rest of the eggs are laid on top. So if a predator were to come, it would eat the unfertilized eggs and get sated and go, and the fertilized eggs are safe at the bottom as a strategy to protect her eggs. You know, quite fascinating. I find that fascinating. The other fascinating thing which we have not mentioned is it's called resource glutting. You might have come across the term before. And that's what is the explanation for why turtles mass nest, you know. So these mass nesting, I mean, Kemp's ridley used to mass nest, but their numbers have crashed. And olive ridleys mass nest. They mass nest in India, they mass nest in Mexico and Costa Rica, a few beaches in each of these places. And it's a phenomenon. It's something else to watch this, right? I mean, in a week's time, up to 200,000 turtles would come and nest. And so many of our associate researchers work in these beaches. Now, these are remote beaches, and they could see the, when you stand on the shore, you can see all these turtle heads bobbing, right? You know, they're all there, and they don't know when they're going to come. They have some special cue. See, the fascinating thing about turtles, this one is called the Olive Ridley. And they don't know why it's Ridley, probably because the life is like a riddle. But I would say sea turtles are so enigmatic, so unpredictable. After all these years, when I talk about turtles, I always add probably, mostly, you know, they often do. I would never say anything with certainty because the minute I find myself saying something, the exact opposite happens. But this mass nesting, so they can never predict when the mass nesting is actually going to start. Is it time to the new moon? Is it time to the full moon? Is it time to a particular tide? We don't know. But on cue, they come. Sometimes they come, you know, over 1 week, every night, 20, 30, 40,000 turtles coming a night. And sometimes, this is another very strange thing. They are reptiles, you know, they're cold-blooded. And they need to nest at night when their bodies wouldn't get overheated. You know, there's no other mechanism for keeping themselves cool. But every decade or so, they would suddenly, you know, not bother about that and come and nest during the day and night. In this, it's called aribada. This mass nesting is called aribada. It's a Spanish term. And they would nest through the day and night. Crazy, crazy stuff. And the most spectacular photos you can find of mass nesting turtles in the daylight, because otherwise it's always dark forms in the night, you know, to count how many there are. And then imagine there are 200,000 nests with each at least 120 eggs. And they're all going to emerge 45 days later, millions of babies suddenly going into the sea. So why they do that? One explanation is resource glutting. You know, how much can the predators eat? Then the rest are safe. Possibly right. I don't know. But yeah, this is another fascinating phenomenon connected to turtles. And I'll just add one more. And this is something which quite funny for us, because we do these turtle walks on the beach, right? So people come to experience, they come to see, hopefully catch a turtle nesting, or at least see how a nest is found and how eggs are collected and all that. And over these last many years, I've seen a number of turtles nest. And then people are watching us and see, we all sit together and at a safe distance for the turtles and watch them nest, watch this process and all. And then she has nested and gone. And then we look for the eggs. And there are no eggs sometimes. You know, I mean, she seems to be, we watch the whole process. And then there are no eggs sometimes. And two, three things. There's two stories here. One is there's something called pseudo-nesting. You know, apparently young females and sometimes even males do a dry run. You know? And so we dig up the whole thing and find there's nothing. You know, that's one thing. The other thing is somehow the eggs will still be there. And yet while we watch her, she seems to confuse us. The most difficult to find nests are when we have watched the whole process. When she's not there, we say, oh, this is an up track and here is a down track. Here is the clearing. I think the nest is here. Often, I myself personally have found the nest with one single probe. You know, we probe to find the nest. With one single poke, I have found a nest scores of times. But when she has nested and gone, she has messed with our mind in some way. I don't know how, what she does. We look pretty foolish because we are the experts, you know, trying to find the nest, and then we don't find it or don't find it for a very long time. Yeah, I could go on, but turtles, crazy creatures,
so
amazing creatures.
When you are looking for a nest, why are you looking for the nests?
Why are we looking for the nest? So many, many reasons. Today there are many reasons, but so one is that. Human removal of eggs at some point of time has gone unchecked. You know, it's not like I remove a nest and leave a nest to nature or whatever. I grab everything I get. And so a huge poaching was going on. Not a single nest was being left. Now I'm talking about 40 years back. And so it became important to collect eggs to save them from poachers. This is how turtle conservation began in Chennai when it began. At that time, that was the primary threat, poaching. But since then, other things have happened. The biggest is that coastal development, like right along the coast, there are all buildings, resorts, hotels, you know, just housing complexes, whatever, street lights. And unfortunately, the young ones are programmed to move towards a brighter horizon. And in nature, it's always the sea surface, you know, with the surf, with the starlight, with the moonlight, which is the brighter surface. But if you're in a city, you can't imagine, because the sea is almost invisible from the beach because we have lit up our shores so much. So every hatchling will end up going landward rather than seaward, and nothing would survive. So even if you find a nest, you know, which if you rub off the tracks, no poacher can ever find a nest. So we hate doing this. We hate interfering in such an age-old process and removing the eggs and trying to save them and all, because she has done this for a long, long time and she knows how to do it. But with this one thing, with lights on the shores, they wouldn't, nothing, none of them would end up going. And we haven't managed to convince any government to switch off lights or, you know, shade the lights or whatever. So we have to remove every egg. And then in cities, there are feral dog populations, which are a problem. And now, the most recently, in the last decade or so, the biggest threat is, not biggest threat, one of the threats is that the introduction of all-terrain vehicles, which can drive on sand. So today we have this youth who are coming in, driving their stupid ATVs on beaches where the turtles could be nesting, where there could be nests. So a whole bunch of reasons. So at one stage, when I started working 22 years back, I was hoping that if we manage to bring enough awareness, we convince the government, we can make the beaches safe, then we can stop collecting eggs. But that has been a dream long lost. You know, today we just have to collect every single nest. And then we also work under time pressure. When she lays the eggs, right, she lays them soft. They have to survive a fall from her cloaca to the bottom of the nest, which for the first eggs is about, you know, actually from the top of the sand to the bottom is about 45 centimeters. And they are falling on each other. So if they were like normal eggs, then they would crack, no? So she lays them leathery and soft. And then over 5 to 9 hours, they harden. And once they harden, the position is frozen, embryonic position. If you take them after that, the survival drops dramatically. You need to relocate within this 5 to 9 hours, actually within 5 hours, ideally. So the same night we have to collect. So we walk at the middle of the night. We start walking at the middle of the night and keep walking through the night and trying to collect them as fresh as they can and relocate them, bearing in mind all the dimensions. Each nest dimension varies based on the number of eggs and her flippers and stuff like that. So we measure the nest and relocate the eggs as perfectly as we can, as close to what she did as possible. Yeah.
So you relocate them inside or how?
What we have is a fenced off section of the beach with bamboo. We just use bamboo and we keep using the same thing. We put them on every season and take them off every season. So for the past, and we managed to use the same material for 5 to 10 years. So it's just a relocated, it's just a fenced off section of the beach. And we relocate them in the sand, just like as she does, with maintaining some distance. There is a thumb rule of how much, you know, there's a protocol of how far each nest should be. It's a little artificial environment, see, because I mean, her nest wouldn't be so close. I mean, accidentally, they could be close, but when we are doing this, they end up putting a lot of, like, 40,000 eggs in one hatchery. We are begging for infections, you know, various kind of problems. So maintaining a hatchery is another science altogether. You know, the distance, various things that we need to look out for each season where we relocate. A whole bunch of things, how far from the tide line, you know. And there also could be other things like rodents could come, crabs could come, many things. So the two parts to the program. One is walking the nights, looking for turtle tracks, eggs, collecting. And the second part is relocating and managing the hatchery and ensuring that hatchlings leave the hatchery and reach the sea when their energies are high. Like, they could emerge anytime during the night, you know. And as they emerge, you have to keep releasing them. So we do every 2 hours, we have a night in the night patrol to keep releasing hatchlings so that they go in full energy to combat the surf and combat the tides and go in, you know.
And what do you mean by release them? Do you dig them up or do they make it out? And I don't understand. What happens then?
Yeah. So, no, by and large, they would come out on their own. So once they come out of the eggs, they actually start moving inside the nest. And then you have a phenomenon called caving in. The top of the nest sort of caves in. There's a small depression, like a cup. Then you know the hatchlings have emerged from the eggs, but they are still inside. Incidentally, coming out of the egg, they have a small egg tooth, which they cut the egg and come out with. And then the egg tooth disappears. But the caving in tells us that the hatchlings have already emerged from the eggs. And then we wait for them to come out. So normally it takes about 45 days on an average. But depending upon the heat, depending upon whether there's been rains or whatever, depending on the temperature, this number could vary, you know. And also for each species, it varies a bit. So we have this thing that we should leave it to nature as much as possible. So 45th, 46th, up to 47 days we wait, and by and large they would emerge. If they have not emerged by then we dig them up. And then when we say release, as I said, they have to come back to the same beach they were born, right? So this imprinting happens in their brain. They have something called magnetite, you know, in their brain to sort of like a GPS to fix the location, the magnetic field of the region. So part of it happens when they are in the nest and part of it happens as they are reaching out to the sea. So we make them walk the last bit. We put them in a basket or something, take them and let them walk in, because that's their natural process, you know. If we let them, our hatchery has to be protected, because if we let them walk, they would walk from the hatchery itself to the sea, but that would mean dogs and other threats and all that. So we keep the hatchery sealed, we can take them in baskets and let them walk the last 10 meters or 15 meters or whatever into the sea. That's the release. And thanks to all these lights on the coast, we have to stand with torchlights in the water to make them come into the sea. Can you imagine that?
And I know this is trivial compared to everything else, but it sounds like you and the people that you work with do a lot of digging during season.
Very much. Yes. Sometimes we find nests very easily, right? And sometimes we don't. And some turtles can really make a large clearing. Some do small clearings. When I say clearing, see, can you imagine something like half a volleyball court could be a clearing, like, you know, large area. And when I say clearing, she throws sand with her flippers, right? She throws it all over the place. So it's extremely flat. And anywhere there could be the nest. So we are bending and poking into the sand to see if you can feel a smooth movement. If you're lucky, we find it in the first 5-10 minutes. If you're unlucky, we are probing for 2 hours. So back-breaking work. And then you might get a false lead because there could be a crab hole or there could be something else. And then you dig and find that you're just, or some child could have played on the beach and, you know, filled it back again and it's loose. And so there are a lot of false leads. So a lot of digging and looking and try and digging the wrong places, right places, whatever. Yes, there's a lot of digging. Yes.
You know, the thing you said earlier about how they lay the eggs for the predators to eat on top reminded me of, I don't remember the number, but I read somewhere that squirrels forget, I don't know, 25 or 50%
of the nuts. And yeah.
You can turn that around. Instead of saying that they forget, maybe they do forget, you can also say that, like, that is their maintenance for the future.
And, absolutely.
And you can say the same thing about here. That's like, you could say that that's sort of the turtle's way of paying rent to the beach.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I've not thought about it that way, but sure, definitely.
So I don't know if this is, this is obviously not possible to convey through speech or to convey over the radio, but you said early on about how moving it is to see this. And, you know, I've seen some extraordinary wild things in my life. But one of the things I've always dreamed about is seeing either turtles nesting or turtles, baby turtles making their way to the ocean. And there is, I don't think I'm alone in that. Can you just talk a little bit about the wonder of that?
See, so we do these weekend walks, right? So, and through the season, every Friday and Saturday night, we allow public to come in to join the turtle walks. When we have to struggle to limit the numbers, it's so popular, it's so popular. We try and not take more than 50 people. So there are 2,000 people walking through there are about 24 weekends, okay, during the nesting season. Lots of people come. And then to see the hatchlings being released, there's no need for limiting number. We just have to cordon them off and let them watch. Thousands of babies, small children, old people come and are shouting in glee. And, you know, they're saying this is the most beautiful thing that they've experienced in their life. And they say, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And, you know, that kind of feeling that, that, you know, it is even for us. I mean, the nesting turtle is moving, intriguing, it's touching in its own way. But hatchlings going into the sea, this little bundles of energy, you know, going there, they look so small and the ocean is so vast. And how are they going to make it? And how are they going to grow big? And what is their life going to be like? And they're not going to be on land. And for us land living creatures, to imagine a little baby plunging into the sea and then not going to come back for the next 15 years or 20 years is quite unfathomable. But that just that energy of that hatchling going in seems to, you know, I mean, stir something, mostly joy, you know, and you know, a sense of awe, a sense of miracle, you know, a sense of the sacred, like the whole thing. It's quite fascinating, yeah. And I would say, while till today, I have seen so many nesting turtles over the last 22 years, but I'm also touched by how other people, when they come and they experience this and how much they are moved, how much they are touched, it is something which stirs something in one, right? I mean, we keep doing this hoping that somewhere this connection, see, I think urban people have lost their connection with nature. The industrialized world, people have lost their connection with nature. But the turtles seem to draw them in some way or the other, you know? And when they come and when they experience this, that something is touched within them, some old connection is reawakened. I mean, that's the hope, and that's why we keep this whole thing going. And I've rarely seen anybody not touched. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. Like, you know, once we had a few times this has happened that we have had a eclipse going on, a lunar eclipse going on top, and then there's a turtle nesting below. I mean, nothing can be more magical, you know, to be in a city. And yet, just at the edge of the city, here we are, suddenly connected to nature like it was millions of years ago. Something else.
So we only have 4 or 5 minutes left, and there's two things I would like to ask you. I know this is very hard in 4 or 5 minutes. One of them is, so what do you see for the future for sea turtles? And second, how can people help sea turtles, and how can they also help work specifically?
So I don't know. This is a difficult question. So largely, we have stayed in this interview. We have stayed with the positive side of things, and since there's only 4 minutes left, I will continue staying on the positive side of things. I think everyone knows that all the 7 species are critically endangered. So I think there's no delusion about in which direction we are heading. You know, so without harping too much on that, what's fascinating is when this group started 22 years ago, or rather when Romulus Whittaker started this in the 1970s, already there was a threat. But we were the one. This operation was the first operation, so to speak, in Tamil Nadu and in most parts of India. I think Orissa, there was a little bit of work going on, but not much conservation work. We were the only, this sort of conservation group, the only group all over India. Today, we have, I think, about 35 groups in India alone. And I think everywhere in the world, wherever turtles are nesting, there are people trying to save them. I mean, at least on the beaches. Largely, I would say, this conservation, the feeling of wanting to conserve turtles has definitely grown. In India, definitely every beach is being monitored, and in most parts of the world, it's being monitored. Kemp's Ridley was pulled back from the brink of extinction, and there are beaches which had gone locally, well, turtles had gone locally extinct, have come back because of the work of conservationists. So, and in our own beaches, turtle population numbers have gone up. You know, nesting has gone up. No, I wouldn't say it's because of our work. Maybe it is because of our work. Maybe it's because other beaches are destroyed more. We also have the phenomenon of number of dead turtles going up. Not only are nesting populations going up, the number of dead turtles are going up. So the Indian expert on this, probably a world expert on this, Karthik Shankar, Dr. Karthik Shankar, says that Olive Ridley populations are recovering worldwide. It's possibly true, but there are two pictures, right? So one is the kind of conservation work that is there within our hands, which is on the beaches of the various parts of the world, where people are doing more work. Definitely positive things are happening there, and that is helping recover populations. I think that's the only handle we have, and that handle we really are using well. But the oceans themselves is another story, where I don't think any regulation we have managed to bring anywhere in the world, and we don't seem to have a handle on, you know, the way fishing happens, overfishing happens. There is a big question mark, and there I would move on from. I'm not concerned just about turtles. I mean, there's the whole ocean there that needs to be saved. There's a whole planet that needs to be saved. So for me, our work doesn't really need any support, in the sense we have survived for 31 years as a voluntary group. Every year we have volunteers coming and joining us who are willing to give their time and walk nights and monitor and all that, because there's joy in doing this kind of work, and I'm sure this will keep continuing. And we are an unfunded organization. We are just a loose coalition of volunteers, and I'm sure we'll keep running like this. When people ask me what they should do, I say, you have to start looking at the whole planet and seeing how we are part of this destructive process and what we can do to change that. You know, what is it that we need to do? And I think answers may be individual. Answers may be that we need, you know that very well, Derek. What we need to do is in various levels. I think from acting individually to acting as a group and activism and changing this whole planetary relationship with non-humans to work towards an inclusive planet, to work towards a planet which is not just for us, for people to realize that this planet was not designed for only humans to live. So it's a huge ask. People ask, why don't you say something more simpler, like, you know, can we contribute? Can we come on turtle walks? I'm saying, if you come on turtle walks, it's for your own joy. It's for you to reconnect. You know, that doesn't really help the turtles. What will help is if you really find the deeper meaning, the connection with life for yourself, is what I say. I don't know what you think of that.
Well, I think that that's a hugely important thing. And I think it is, it says everything we need to know about this entire toxic culture, that these creatures who survived the age of dinosaurs and the mass extinction at the end of that have been critically endangered by this culture. And I think that points us toward, you're the interview subject here, so I hate to say what we should do, but I'm going to anyway, which is that we need to do exactly what you said and make our loyalty to, and do not what you've said, but what you've done, and to make our loyalty to the sea turtles or to the salmon or to, you know, whatever creatures it is that you love the most, the prairie dogs,
right,
our loyalty to them absolute.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you want to say? We have like 1 minute. Is there anything else you want to say about sea turtles in 1 minute? This has all been...
I think for me, it's been a great gift. One of the greatest gifts life has given me has been the opportunity to work with turtles. You know, I'm humbled by the experience, and I'm very grateful, and I hope to keep going on with this. Like, you know, people tell me this is a youthful activity. You're over 50. what are you still doing? And I'm like, you know, is there an age for these kind of things? I would like to walk when I'm 70 if I can, you know, if I'm around, like, because it gives me so much joy, like, you know. And my group is called Student Sea Turtle Conservation Network, and they come and see a 50-year-old guy, like, you know, what are you doing here? Like, and I am one of the students of life, like, you know, holding this group together still, like, you know. And my partner is 60 years old. So it's amazing. So I think turtles have given me life. Turtles have given me my energy and love for life and hope, no, that you go on living, that you go on trying, because as long as the hatchlings are going into sea, you can keep hoping. And that's what turtles have given me, and I'm very grateful for that.
Well, thank you so much for that, and thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Arun. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.